everybody. Happy Mother's Day. Wait a minute. Welcome to Monday. Hope you had a great weekend. Yes, indeed. I was doing reading a review of a book entitled The Spanish Holocaust, Inquisition and Extermination in 20th Century Spain. Wow. Fascism. You know, once again, the Catholic Church is implicated in Francisco Franco's systematic slaughter of hundreds of thousands of Spaniards. Oh, that's for another time. This hour, sponsored by E. Johnston in Everett, Washington. E. Johnston's message, I hear only bits of your program, but it is worth your time and my money. Keep it lit. Thanks, EJ. I don't know if that's a man or a woman, so I just say thanks, CJ. I appreciate it very much. So now Obama is on the cover of Newsweek with the title, First Gay President. Remember when they called Clinton the first black president? Ay. What's her name? It's an article by one of Newsweek's political writers, Andrew Sullivan, an out member of the gay community. Tina Brown, of course, is the one that comes up with these covers now that she's the, what is she, the editor, publisher, both of Newsweek. But the picture of Obama with the halo above him in the rainbow hues of the gay liberation flag, it hit the newsstands today. And, you know, it's in the wake of Obama's statement last week that he is in favor of gay marriage. And, excuse me, White House Press Secretary, according to the LA Times, White House Press Secretary Jay Carney, when asked if Obama had any thoughts about the cover today, said, quote, I don't know if he's seen it, and I haven't spoken to him about it. Okay, well, that's cool. But isn't this whole story, the reason I'm bringing it up, no, it has nothing to do with global climate change and fracking and death and destruction all over the planet, but it does have to do with one of my favorite subjects, and that's watching the right wing in this country just wet itself in its anger and frustration. I'm sure Tony Perkins was all over media this weekend, or will be tomorrow, about this cover. Poor Tony. If Tony ever just relaxed and, you know, went out on a date with a real nice kind of professorial type and they'd sit around and talk about comparative religion and then go home and have sex, I think Tony Perkins would be, I'm talking about, you know, a male professor of comparative religion. Tony and his date would go home and have a nice relaxed evening of sex talk and sex play, and then Tony Perkins would be forever cured of his homophobic ugliness. Or not. But anyway, tomorrow on The View, Mr. Obama will be on The View, and he's expected to speak further on his support for gay marriage. And again, the reason the story, it affects me on two levels. First of all, it is a civil right long denied to people in this country. I cannot believe that in my lifetime there were miscegenation, so-called, rules on the books, that white folk and gay, black folk couldn't get married. It's equally stunning to me that such laws exist where it concerns same-sex couples. What's even more stunning to me, as an American, as somebody who believes in certain parts of the Constitution as being essential to liberty and freedom, that we've had 31 states now pass constitutional amendments banning the civil right of same-sex marriage. What's up with that? I mean, This to me, it's just so bizarre. I cannot understand this anti-homophobic attitude. I can't. I cannot get it in my head. And when I was a teenager, I wrote for a gay publication here in Atlanta 25 years ago. I had a column called Straight Talk. Get it? But, you know, my contribution to that publication was topical subjects as viewed through the eyes of a heterosexual, you know, and this magazine was targeted at the gay population here in Atlanta. And I had a lot of fun writing for them. The publisher and editor were friends of mine from way back. And in one of the columns, one of the short stories, actually, was, they were supposed to be columns, but they could be biographical, autobiographical, you know, little vignette stories, whatever. And I wrote about how when I was a teenager, how I was as homophobic and as much of a verbal gay basher as anybody else in my little high school clique, and how much I was ashamed of it and regretted it. Nothing ever, you know, violent, physically violent, is verbally violent, real nasty, nasty stuff. And how I was able to, at some point, nothing specifically happened, except at some point to realize how insane that point of view was and is. And I went through that from the time I was probably 14 and then came out of that darkness by the time I was 17. But in that 2 or 3 year period, not in school, no bullying was allowed in school, but on the streets of Toledo, if we'd be cruising around in somebody's 55 Chevy or 57 Chevy with the top down, and you would see somebody on a street corner, a man on the street corner that, you know, we punk-ass teenage high schoolers considered, oh yeah, look, he's queer, we would drive by and do all kinds of obscene gestures and scream obscenities and awful, awful stuff. Horrible stuff. And I don't know where all of that dissolved for me and evaporated. But it did. It just went completely away to the point where as an adult, I can never understand how teenagers who are essentially, most teenagers are punks to begin with. Let's face it. We all were. And some of us come out of it. Some of us don't. We become Republican. But teenage, for the most part, teenage years where it's all so intense and so it can be so vicious and so mean and also it can be, you know, exploratory and fun and exciting. I don't mean to paint teen years totally dark, but that's where a lot of that stuff comes out. And then eventually I think people get over it and you have to go back and repair the damage that you did, if you did damage. If it was screaming insults at people, I don't know if you can track those people down 30 years later, 40 years later, but if you can, you should. Kind of like the 12-step program for addiction. At some point, you have to apologize for all the damage that you did. But I don't know at what point it dawned on me that to be so-called homophobic or a verbal gay basher or whatever was madness, was total insanity. It made no sense. And it wasn't because I never heard churches talk about homosexuality back in the day. I never heard preachers come out and say, you know, there was no discussion at all about homosexuality, period, much less same-sex marriage. It was just something that was off the table. You just didn't talk about it. So much of the stuff in the 50s, you just didn't talk about it. But for Obama to finally come out and make a statement like he made, you know, maybe pushed into it by his vice president, and now to watch these adult people, Christians, whether they're white or black, especially the preachers, black preachers, white preachers, just going out of their minds about this, like, it's almost like Obama created some art like Andre Serrano called Piss Christ and immersed a cross in a jar of urine to show how these right-wingers have destroyed Christianity. And the member reaction to that? Oh, my God. We'll be right back.
The Mike Malloy Show. All substance, no abuse.
21 past the hour. Andrew Sullivan wrote back in 1989, quote, "It's one of the richest ironies of our society's blind spot toward gays that essentially conservative social goals should have the appearance of being so radical. But gay marriage is not a radical step. It avoids the mess of domestic partnership. It is humane. It is conservative in the best sense of the word. It's also about relationships. Given that gay relationships will always exist, what possible social goal is advanced by framing the law to encourage those relationships to be unfaithful, undeveloped, and insecure?" End quote. Andrew Sullivan from 25 years ago, roughly. But it is fun watching the contortions of these so-called Christians over this issue. Freshman Representative James Lankford, Republican of Oklahoma, told Think Progress in a recent interview that he was against laws designed to protect employees from workplace discrimination based on their sexual orientation because of his belief that being gay is a choice. This guy thinks that if a boss discovers that someone in his employ is gay, that is grounds to fire the person. The person may be an excellent worker. Doesn't matter. According to this freak, Lankford from Oklahoma, Lankford said, "Race and sexual preferences are two different things. One is behavior-related and preference-related, and one is something inherently, skin color, something obvious, that kind of stuff. You don't walk up to someone on the street and look at them and say, gay or straight. I think it's a choice issue. Our tendencies and such, yes, but I think it's a choice issue." End quote. See, there's another one. Poor Lankford. Poor Lankford. Lankford isn't the only punk-ass Republican, freshman Republican, to express opposition to a change in attitude. By the way, a bipartisan group of senators has renewed calls for hearings on the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. It's a piece of legislation that would expand employee anti-discrimination language to include sexual orientation and gender identity. But, of course, Lankford is against that. Also, last week, Representative Alan West, you know, the freak from Florida, said such protections were unnecessary because discrimination based on sexual orientation simply didn't happen. What? Alan West said, quote, "That don't happen out here in the United States of America," end quote. Now, I'm not making up his language. That's how Think Progress quotes him. Alan West. Boy, there's another one, huh? Switching subject. It's hard for me to get geared into the ugliness that we have to get geared into in this program on Monday. It's kind of a catch-all, little bits and pieces picked up over the weekend. As you know, I used to work at CNN, and then again years later at CNN International. When I first worked at CNN back in the early 80s, it was a news-gathering organization and a news-disseminating organization, period. News. Only factual reportage on world events and national events. And it was fun working there. It was intense. A lot of pressure. A lot of coffee and Coke to keep going. But it was fun to work at a place that had just been born with a whole new concept. You know, this is before the Weather Channel. This is before MSNBC, before the garbage network of Rupert Murdoch. There was a network called Satellite News Service that was run by CBS. They both came out about the same time, and Ted Turner, took him about 15 minutes to figure out that he had to buy Satellite News Service and throw it away so that CNN would dominate, which is exactly what he did. But CNN has gone right down the bathtub drain. It really has. And, that's sad to say, but CNN, I don't know. I think eventually it's going to be bought by, over at Facebook, and they'll turn it into some kind of a dating service. But, something happened, over the weekend that I want to share with you. Tamron Hall, I mentioned this Friday, Tamron Hall at MSNBC had this freak on Tim Carney, a Washington Examiner writer and a suck-up for anything right-wing. And when we come back, I'll play a little piece of sound for you that I think you'll find interesting. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy. Before the hour. This hour is being sponsored by E. Johnston in Everett, Washington. EJ's message, I hear only bits of your program, but it is worth your time and my money. Keep it lit. Thanks, EJ. I appreciate your sponsorship and your message very much. Okay, CNN has gotten so lost in Yonkers. They're just lost, completely lost. I don't think CNN has a clue as to what their mission is any longer. And this causes Ted Turner just mountains of anguish and stomach pain and regrets for ever having hooked up with AOL Time Warner at first to begin with. But one of their hosts is Howard Kurtz, who really has a career that's been in decline for probably the past 10 years. And he got his bloomers in a wad over MSNBC anchor Tamron Hall for cutting off Tim Carney when Tim Carney started getting kind of snotty with her on her show on Friday. I'll play this for you in a second. But Kurtz defended Carney, saying that all he did was, quote, challenge her coverage of the report on Mitt Romney, end quote, which is not true. And then Kurtz said, quote, it was Tamron Hall who was being insulting by silencing him, which is not true. Kurtz said he believed it was, quote, perfectly acceptable, end quote, for Carney to state that, in his opinion, the story was being hyped up by the media. Howard Kurtz is obviously auditioning to go to work for the Rupert Murdoch Terror Broadcast Organization. The story, of course, was about Mitt Romney and his bullying and his attacking a gay student and all this little garbagey stuff that Mitt Romney is becoming so known for, both as a teenager in his 20s, his 40s, his 60s. This is Mitt Romney. Now, the big argument last week, Jesus, God, why are we talking about somebody's high school career? That's not what was being discussed as far as I was concerned. What was being discussed, and apparently Tamron Hall felt the same way, was how Mitt Romney handles these kinds of situations. How does he handle it? He lies. He sneaks. He obfuscates. He looks at you like a big dumbass puppy. And this guy wants to be president. Now, I'm going to play this bit of tape or the bit of sound for you. This is Tamron Hall. And the mail you'll hear is Tim Carney with the Washington Examiner and a right wing suck up from the word go.
Okay, well, I'll talk about the marijuana in one second, but what you're doing here is a typical media trick. You hype up a story, and then you justify the second day coverage of the story by saying, oh, well, people are talking about it. Here's how Romney responded to it. No, let's move on to substantive
issues. You don't have to answer a single question I ask you. You didn't have to accept the invitation to come on. You knew what we were going to be discussing.
Yes,
I'm not trying to put a job on. Hang on, Tim, because you're kind of in my house here. The problem is this. The story is out there, and you're right. I am not saying that we should belabor what happened 50 years ago. We're talking about the response by the campaign and by the governor,
You're bringing up a meta story here, which is, what is the Romney response to this other non-story? I'm trying to go meta on you and say, here's the media treatment.
You don't want me to go
Romney
anything
response.
On you because you're actually irritating me right now. I'm going to be honest with you.
Because
you knew the topics we were going to discuss. You knew them. You agreed. And we are not talking or demeaning. Listen, 50 years ago, I was a much tougher kid probably than Mitt Romney was in high school. I'm not talking about the issue of whether he was bullying or not. He says he doesn't remember. To be fair, I cannot say he does. What I'm asking you about is how the campaign has handled this decision, handled this situation, how he handled the Colorado reporter, how he handled same-sex marriage
Colorado.
Where he said he agrees with gay parents being able to adopt, but he does not agree with same-sex marriage. Just the handling of questions beyond the economy. If you're not comfortable talking about that, I am A-okay, but you're not going to come on and insult me. You're not going to come on and insult the network when you knew what you were going to talk about. Done. Now let me talk to Jimmy. Yes, I am. Jimmy, let me go to you. And I say this with all great respect because we're not ambushing Jimmy or
all
Tim.
Right.
We want you to talk about...
That's good enough. Tamron Hall, I don't know what this little punk ass Tim Carney thought he was up against. But the way it works, when you're invited to be a guest on these programs, unless you are really a national figure, when you're invited to be a guest, like this guy, you are usually a day before or a couple of hours before, you get the phone call. I've gone through this so many times. The phone call will be from one of the producers of MSNBC, say, based in New York. It doesn't matter where the interviewer is going to be interviewing you from, but you get the call from New York. And there'll be an editorial assistant, and he or she will start asking you questions. You know, starts out, hi, Mike, you're going to be a guest at 3:10 this afternoon with XYZ. Now, here's what we're going to be talking about. Tax increases on the wealthy. How do you feel about that? And then the person being interviewed, in this case it would be me, or the other day it would be Tim Carney, you answer. And the editorial assistant takes note of what you're saying. And the reason they do this is to kind of get a feel of what direction you're going to go when you go on the air. Now, if you are honest and legit, you don't say, well, I think 2 + 2 = 4 when you're being interviewed. And then when you are by the editorial assistant, and then when you go on television, say, I've always believed 2 + 2 = 5. You don't do that. That's not cricket, so to speak. The pre-interview is to find out where you are on a topic. And then notes are taken and handed, when your turn comes up to be the guest, it's handed to the anchor person who's going to talk with you. And it's just fair. I mean, it's fair to do that. They don't censor your point of view. They just want to know what it is. That's all. So this guy, and I think Tamron Hall, that's what she meant when she said, this is not what you said. You knew what we were going to be talking about. You knew what the topic was. So this guy, Tim Carney, was obviously caught with his bloomers down around his ankles, and he didn't know how to get out of it. And good on Tamron Hall, and I said this on Friday, for finally taking one of these little punk-ass right-wingers and smacking him upside his head, so to speak, saying, no, punk, you're not going to come on my program. You're not. And I love it when she said, you're in my house. Ow, where did you hear that, Tamron? You're not going to come in my, you know, essentially you're in my house right now. That's right. When you're asked to be a guest on somebody's program, or if you call a talk show, that's why I cannot stomach these punks that call me these right-wingers. They have no respect. They have no sense of, just common courtesy. It's beyond them. So, you know, we take a chance. We don't pre-interview or pre-screen anybody on this program. Kathy will say, what do you want to talk about? Where are you calling from? Okay, hold on. And then when they come on, well, you've heard, you know, I'm not going to go through all this. On television, it's a little bit different, though. On these cable news shows, there's a much bigger audience listening to Tamron Hall than ever would listen to this program. It's live television. There is a delay, but it's live television. And it's just the way the game is played, and everybody knows this. The point I'm trying to get to, not only did Tamron Hall do the right thing, not only did this punk-ass Tim Carney do the wrong thing, but to have Howard Kurtz, who is just a real snot, I mean, he really is. Some people are interesting, but their politics are wrong. Some people are, their politics are right, but they're not interesting. This guy is just a snot, Howard Kurtz. He's just, he really, really is. So for him to come on, a CNN guy, and all he's got to talk about is how Tamron Hall figuratively smacked upside the head this right-wing troll that came on her program after he was A, invited, B, pre-interviewed, C, agreed to the ground rules, and then comes on and acts like that. Good on you, Tamron. Good for you. Now, if all interviewers would do that, you know, when you get these smarmy right-wing bastards that come on and you ask them questions and they know their answer is garbage, so they come up with all this tangential crap. Well, I think the point was made with Tamron Hall. If you're a right-winger and you're going to go on her program, listen to the pre-interview, listen to what you're saying, because that's what you're going to be expected to say when you are interviewed on live television. And if you deviate, fine. If you take off on an entirely different tangent, somebody like Tamron Hall is going to slap you upside your head and make you go sit in a corner, which you will do. I loved it. But the thing that really got to me was poor CNN host and Daily Beast columnist Howard Kurtz talking about Tamron Hall. Oh, Howard, sit down and shut up, for heaven's sake. Go see if you can find a story to write about that's really important. We'll be right back.
For
the hour. This hour has been sponsored by E. Johnston in Everett, Washington, whose message is, I hear only bits of your program, but it is worth your time and my money. Keep it lit. E. Johnston. Thanks, EJ. I appreciate that a great deal. Thanks a lot for sponsoring the hour. Ralph Reed. You talk about a corpse rising from some murky cemetery someplace. Remember Ralph Reed, the big organizer for the moral majority? And then didn't he work with Pat Robertson's attempt to become a dictator, religious dictator of the United States back in, when was that? I forget.
Wasn't he part of that Tom DeLay, Abramoff scandal?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's a real scum sucker. Yeah. But he's just
leading. Ripping off the Native Americans, right?
Yeah. He's a leading Christian, and he made lots and lots and lots of money defrauding, certainly in spirit, if not in fact, various Indian tribes who were bidding against each other for casinos here and casinos there. And, of course, Ralph Reed waded right into it, being the punk ass that he is, and took everybody for a ride. And, yeah, he was a real good friend of Jack Abramoff, that Ralph Reed. I thought this guy had disappeared. But why is he treated like a serious commentator? Carolee, writing at Crooks and Liars, points out that he was on one of the Sunday morning bobblehead shows, and it was on This Week with George Judah Stephanopoulos, and the discussion turned to whether Mitt Romney's pattern of bullying others and his attitude of entitlement is relevant to the election at hand. It absolutely is, of course, as Carolee says, and I agree, not necessarily because of the incidents themselves that are in this sick cult followers' past, but because this is more evidence that the man lacks empathy in any sense, that others less fortunate than he inhabit this place we call the United States. So, Ralph Reed has a different opinion. After enumerating all of Romney's wonderful qualities, Ralph Reed actually had the nerve to ask who would want to serve, quote, if they know people will be dumpster diving into your high school or prep school, end quote. Really? Did you really say that, you little baby-faced devil you? Because, as Carolee points out, nothing says dumpster diving like half the Republican Party claiming Barack Obama wasn't born in the United States. Or that he is really a Kenyan usurper. And the other half claiming that he's really a Muslim and not a Christian, but somehow he was influenced by an inflammatory Christian pastor in the church he attended for 20 years. And other assorted lies they flog every goddamn day. Nothing says dumpster diving, eh, Ralph? Like pointing out his time in Indonesia as a time when he was indoctrinated by imams. Or the nonsense they came up with a week before about how he dealt drugs in college. So here's this punk Ralph Reed calling a story corroborated by five independent witnesses who were involved. A band of religious thugs responsible for lies, rumors, and smears. Wow. And this piece of waste wants to be president. Carolee says, I have a proposal for Ralph Reed. He belongs in prison to begin with, but he can man up and tell his birther eliminationist wingnut followers to recant all the lies they've told and magnified about Barack Obama. And I'll shut up about the true stories of Mitt Romney's past. Better yet, why doesn't Ralph just crawl back under the rock he came from? Yeah, we've been talking about Ralph Reed crawling back under the rock, back into his crawl space, back into his nasty little cobwebby spider roach-filled hidey hole for the past 20 years. Ralph Reed. How did these guys get invited on? Well, that's the wrong question. Why does anybody watch these Sunday shows? There's nothing there. They're masturbatory right-wing fun fests where they sit around and pretend as though they're saying something of significance or something important or something of deep and abiding profundity. You ever notice that? And I used to watch them. The only one I watch anymore really is what's his name on CBS, Bob Schieffer. Yeah, only because he's an old guy like me. Actually, he's older than I am. But Judas Stephanopoulos and Wolf Blitzer and who else? Who else? Who else hosts these Circle Jerks? Who else is on? Oh, yeah. Meet the Press. Press the Meet. Who's on that? I don't even know anymore. I guess it doesn't matter. All right. I'm going to try real hard to get into serious radio talk show topics when we come back after the break. But there's just one thing. When we come back, you're going to love this. I'll save it till we come back after the break. It's one of those little throwaway pieces. It involves Rabbi Nachum Schifrin. Rabbi Nachum Schifrin. You're going to find this, or at least I did. I mean, you may find it boring as hell, but I find it extraordinarily hysterical. Stay with us. We'll be back momentarily. I'm Mike Malloy. Welcome back. 7 past the hour. This hour being sponsored by Anonymous. And the message from Anonymous: Mike, keep fighting the good fight. We need good atheist voices like yours to tell the truth and expose the fundamentalists to be the dangerous frauds that they are. My wife Joanna has been a big fan of yours for years and fights for injured workers against corporate giants. She's an angel for workers and listens to you every night. Thanks, Anonymous. And props to your wife for doing that. Okay, the little story here about Rabbi Nachum Schifrin. This is from the Center for, or the Council on American Islamic Relations, CAIR, C-A-I-R. I'll just read the press release. The California chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations, along with Jewish Voice for Peace and Progressive Christians Uniting, all three groups today called on state and national Republican Party leaders to repudiate hate speech by a candidate for the U.S. Senate who recently told a cheering audience, quote, "I am an Islamophobe, and everything we need to know about Islam we learned on 9/11, end quote. Now, this is during a May 3rd speech in San Mateo, California, and the candidate is Rabbi Nachum Schifrin, who also resorted to racist language when he said, now listen to this, listen closely. This is Rabbi Nachum Schifrin, quote, "We're getting sucker punched because we as white, yes, I said it, as white Christian Americans are being taught that somehow we're to blame for all the problems," end quote. White Christian Americans? We white Christian Americans? Rabbi Nachum Schifrin? What changed over the weekend? I mean, Anyway, in a joint statement, The Christian, Muslim, and Jewish organizations responded to this, said, quote, "There should be no place for hate speech of any kind in our nation's political discourse. Whenever one faith or ethnicity is targeted by hate, it is our duty as Americans to challenge that hatred and to instead promote mutual understanding and tolerance. We urge GOP leaders in California and nationwide to repudiate this candidate's hate speech and to encourage greater respect for diversity within party ranks," end quote. I just wonder if the Council on American Islamic Relations and Jewish Voice for Peace and Progressive Christians Uniting, I wonder if they promote mutual understanding and tolerance where it concerns a woman's right to privacy and sovereignty over her own body. I'm just wondering. That's all. I've heard of Jewish Voice for Peace. I've heard of Council on American Islamic Relations. And I think I've heard of Progressive Christians Uniting. But I just wonder what these three organizations, what their position is where it concerns, the privacy that a woman should have. I mean, I hate to even say it that way. I mean, it's a given, privacy. I mean, how many men? Oh, I don't want to get on it tonight. I really don't. It's just, and I also wonder what these three organizations think about same-sex marriage. Really? I wonder. I wonder what these organizations think of those two issues. I fully agree with their outrage at this Nachum Schifrin. But I don't know. This is so weird. He says we're getting sucker punched because we as white, yes, I said it, as white Christian Americans are being taught that somehow we are to blame for all the problems. Rabbi, newsflash, unless you're a phony, unless your name is really, Willie O'Reilly, maybe it is, and you just go by the name Rabbi Nachum Schifrin. But I have a surprise for you. You're not a Christian. You really aren't. That's kind of when you use the term rabbi, it's a dead giveaway, pal. All right, let's do something that makes sense here, sort of. From Prairie 2, weren't you paying attention? He writes, if I gave you the impression last week that the Republicans were losing the battle for oligarchy, I apologize. They are far from defeated. That is, if we let them get away with it. Their efforts to undermine the economy and destroy civilization continue full ahead. Over the weekend, 250,000 people that were formerly receiving long-term unemployment benefits were cast into poverty with little hope. The corporate media is reporting this as resulting from the declining unemployment rate in certain states. But really, this comes from the Republicans in Congress insisting on the number of weeks of eligibility being reduced sharply, while they complain about the lack of jobs under Obama. Nearly half of these unfortunate souls live in California, a state that faces a ballooning crisis brought on by a right-wing scam that has allowed rich Californians to avoid paying taxes for the past 30 years. Only a supermajority in the state legislature can fix the problem, and so far Republicans have been able to hang on to a third of the seats to keep this fiscal treason going. In the U.S. Senate, the routine renewal of the Import-Export Bank Authorization Bill has been held up by Republicans who are intent on crippling the economy before the election. So egregious is this move to block a bill that even passed the Republican-controlled House that Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid is reported to be, quote, visibly agitated, end quote. He is normally so passive as to be mistaken for one of the marble statues that line the Senate hallways. If this bill doesn't pass, at least 300,000 manufacturing jobs will disappear overnight with the end of the Export-Import Bank loan guarantees at the end of May. The Import-Export Bank is a kind of subsidy for the big companies like Boeing and the major defense contractors, so it normally receives a rubber stamp. Republicans call it a waste of taxpayer money, even though it is actually self-funded by fees and no tax money is required. Greece seems unable to form a new government following parliamentary elections because of the refusal to cooperate by socialists on the left and Nazis on the right. I didn't mean figurative Nazis. They call themselves Nazis. What's old is new again, right? This will force new elections and the likely emergence of a government that will leave the euro behind. This is a dangerous road, but the only one that makes any sense. Even in Germany, where they haven't really suffered from the austerity insanity, the locals are starting to rebel, with Chancellor Angela Merkel's minority government losing a large number of seats in local elections. They join the French people, who realize that their nations are under threat from the bankers. Americans are much slower to catch on. The big new talking point on the Sunday Talking Head shows is that Obama is mischaracterizing Republicans because they are really, completely in favor of regulation, always have been. This comes in the wake of a multi-billion dollar loss in trading activity by J.P. Morgan Chase, largest bank in the U.S. They were, by the way, risking depositors' money while doing this. And this activity would be banned under the Dodd-Frank Act if Republicans would allow it to go into effect. The right-wing talking heads weren't quite ready for this complete reversal of their stand on regulation. Up until Friday, they didn't want regulation of any kind, and they couldn't keep straight that they shouldn't back up their new pro-regulation talking points by saying how bad regulation of any kind really is. If the banks don't collapse this week, then by next Sunday, they'll be back to the same crap. If the banks do collapse this week, it will be Obama's fault for not regulating them. Weren't you paying attention? PrairieNumeral2.com.
Was history made in prison, then the fascists they would be. So the promise of an Aryan world would never materialize.
So why did they all come out of the woodwork
on the day the Nazi died? The world is riddled with maggots, the maggots are getting fat. They're making a tasty meal of all the bosses and bureaucrats.
They're taking over the boardrooms and they're fat and full of pride.
And they all came out of the woodwork on the day the Nazi died. So if you meet with these historians, I'll tell you what to say. Tell them that the Nazis never really went away. They're out there burning houses down and peddling racist lies. And we'll never rest again until every Nazi dies.
Here come 50,000 watts of free speech. It's Mike Malloy.
It's come through a hole. It's coming from a field that this ain't exactly real.
Or it's real, but it ain't exactly there.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
past the hour. The Spanish Holocaust, I was reading a review of that book. And I've mentioned many times about the complicity, the active complicity of the Catholic Church in the extermination of the Jews and the furtherance of the Nazi regime, and skipped over completely because apparently I just was not aware of Franco's collaboration with the Catholic Church in Spain during the early part of the Spanish Civil War. It went on for, you know, years, but also, the amount of people in that country that were killed. Hitler and Mussolini were supplying, you probably know this, arms to Franco, and the Soviet Union was trying to support the Spanish Republic. And And the actual war went on from 1936 to 1939, and then, of course, everything moved further into Europe with the invasion of Poland. But, and I know that, that you know about the Abraham Lincoln Brigade and all that, how the Spanish Civil War was kind of the opening act to the global Holocaust that was World War II that followed on its heels. 200,000 soldiers died in battle, and a further large but unknown number of civilians were killed by Franco's bombing of Spanish cities. Guernica, you're familiar with that painting? Vast columns of refugees in flight. He used to send his planes after the refugees and strafe them and bomb them and kill them. Franco. There were also about 200,000 men and women who were deliberately executed during the war. And 20,000 supporters of the Republic who were shot after it ended. Additional tens of thousands of civilians and refugees who died in concentration camps and prisons. Spanish Holocaust. But as a reviewer points out, in smashing democracy and what was really timid agricultural reform in Spain, and in restoring the traditional hierarchy of the Roman Catholic Church, the army, big landowners, and an authoritarian state, the Spanish version of fascism was very much a fundamentalist movement. And like so many political and religious fundamentalisms, it had a particular ferocity toward women. Franco's troops practiced gang rape to frighten newly captured towns into submission. And until media-savvy superiors silenced them, his officers even boasted about this to American and British correspondents. Tens of thousands of women had their heads shaved and were force-fed castor oil, a powerful laxative, then jeered as they were paraded through the streets, soiling themselves. Many had their breasts branded with the phalangist symbol of yoke and arrows. In Toledo, a United Press correspondent reported Franco's soldiers shot more than 20 pregnant women from a maternity hospital. Much larger all-female groups were executed elsewhere, just taken out and shot. Troops marched through one town waving rifles adorned with the underwear of women they had raped and murdered. One of Franco's senior generals declared, quote, "It is necessary to spread terror. We have to create the impression of mastery, eliminating without scruples or hesitation all those who do not think as we do," end quote. Did you see the movie The Labyrinth? If you didn't see that movie, let me recommend it. It's about, sort of, one particular commandante in the Spanish Civil War. Pan's Labyrinth is what I mean. Thanks, Kathy. I don't mean The Labyrinth. Pan's Labyrinth. If you ever get a chance and want just a quick glimpse, the story, Pan's Labyrinth, is not about, that's just the context, the Spanish Civil War, where the story is set. But the next time you don't have anything to do, look up Nazis and Catholic priests. Look up Franco and Catholic priests. I rest my case.
I can see death's disguise hanging on me. You leave me in my misery. Trouble, oh, trouble, please be kind. I don't know.
the Flying Monkey Free Zone. It's Mike Malloy.
Before the hour. This hour is being sponsored by Anonymous. Anonymous, Mike, keep fighting the good fight. Anonymous writes, we need good atheist voices like yours to tell the truth and exposing the fundamentalists to be the dangerous frauds that they are. My wife, Joanna, has been a big fan for years and fights for injured workers against corporate giants. She is an angel for workers and listens to you every night. Good on you, Joanne. Thanks, Anonymous. Why did I bring up a little bit about the Spanish Civil War? Because any fascist movement has at its, especially during its beginnings, this attack on women. And when you combine political fascism and religious fascism, you have an absolute boiling cauldron of anti-woman attitudes. And it's one of the 14 danger signs or warning signs of incipient fascism. And it's here. That's the reason I bring it up, because it's here. It's just unrelenting. Now, granted, the mainstream or the popular media have all moved on from the story. Temporarily, until another physician is gunned down, or a clinic is bombed, or you know, some outrageously egregious, stupefyingly asinine activity takes place. But the assault on women is more than just going after clinics and doctors who may or may not perform abortions. It's also the legislation that is being passed that is ultra violence against women. Ultra violent. And the perfect example, I think, happened over the weekend. Where is it? The House has agreed. Now, I know this sounds like we reported it last week. They were debating it last week. But the House, under the Republican control, has agreed to $310 billion in cuts to the budget, and you know where the cuts are coming from. It's just astonishing. Food stamps, children's health insurance, Medicaid, child abuse prevention, spouse abuse prevention. This is violence against women. This is the kind of violence against women that doesn't send a woman immediately to an emergency room because she's been beaten or raped or cut or shot or strangled. This is the kind of violence that can drive women insane. This is the kind of violence that hurts women and children. And the Republicans do this on an ongoing, day-to-day, moment-to-moment basis. Republicans who became captives of this pledge to never raise taxes, thanks to this filthy puke Grover Norquist. Never to raise taxes. So, rather than tax people in this country who have had a free ride for the past 35 years, an absolute free ride, you know, I get so sick of hearing all Americans whine. Well, most people who are informed do not. But conservative Democrats, all right-wingers in the Republican Party, the entire Republican Party, almost all members of Congress whine about Taxes are too high. Taxes had never been low in the, lower in this country. Income taxes had never been lower in this country. Okay, I don't want to say never, but in the modern era, they have never been this low. We do not pay taxes in this country. We avoid taxes in this country. And these pissy millionaires and billionaires who are just whining and blubbering and shedding all these phony-ass tears, they're the ones involved in the violence against women. Now, of course, they don't make the rules. It's this filth in the House, this filth, this utter filth that is Republican legislators who would be terribly offended. If you went up to Paul Ryan and said, you know, you son of a bitch, you ought to be in jail for abusing women and children. You know, he would look at you as if you were some kind of a, you know, dust on his lapel of his $3,000 suit and just try to flick you off in the same manner. But these are the people who are responsible. These are the ones who commit violence against women. So the whole thing, this whole attitude toward women is a manifestation of approaching fascism that just stands out like a klaxon. Is that what's on? Is that the siren on a, is that the one on a emergency vehicle that goes, wah! Wah! I think that's called a klaxon. But here it is. I mean, if you refuse to take a look at the political philosophy of these right-wingers, if you refuse to look beyond their insatiable greed, their insane attitudes toward themselves and their own families, their dependence on catastrophically crazy religious baloney. If you look beyond, if that doesn't impress you, does the violence being generated against women and children, are you aware that the pigs in the House of Representatives have decided not to cut one goddamn dime from this war budget, this death budget, but to eviscerate programs that primarily help women, secondarily children, and of course unemployed males also. But I'd be a son of a bitch. That's the reason I think that a lot of people, not a lot, a handful of us are screaming about this incipient fascism. And again, it's one of the 14 clear warning signs. They did it in Italy. They did it in Spain. They did it in Germany. Pick any country that went fascist, and you will see this horrific pattern of violence against women and children. Women and children. And Francisco Franco was just one more in a long line of people who, males who, with the full support, once again, of the Catholic Church in Spain. The Church in Spain was waiting for the restoration of its exalted position. They didn't want fascism. Franco didn't want fascism. What Franco wanted was feudalism. He wanted a return to a feudal state. And, of course, the Catholic Church was more than willing. Are you kidding me? Oh, amen and amen. You do remember, don't you, Truth Seeker, the Spanish Inquisition. So, I don't know how to avoid the interlocking reality of fascism and fundamental religion. I don't know how to avoid it. I really don't. It's everywhere you look. This idea of a marriage contract between people of the same sex that has just thrown these right-wingers into a frothing, mind-bending, screeching, screaming frenzy is another example. I mean, if how the pie is cut in this country economically doesn't get your attention. Okay. But what about this other stuff? You know, a lot of people say, well, and I've said it, well, these issues aren't important. I think I said last week, now, I didn't say they weren't important. I just said, you know, we've got to move on to the big issues. But this is one of the big issues, violence against women and the refusal to recognize that people can be the same sex and want to put together a marriage marriage contract. You know, when did the church decide that it had the power? It doesn't have any goddamn power about marriage. There's not a religious figure in the world that doesn't wind up by saying, and now by the power vested in me by the state of blank, I pronounce you man and wife. So don't marry same-sex couples, you dolts. Don't do it. But why do you stand in the way? Why do you mock Obama? Why? I mean, well, the answer is very simple. Fascism.
Tonight, how much he hates these people. It's Mike Malloy.
Before the hour, this hour has been sponsored by Anonymous, whose message is, Mike, keep fighting the good fight. We need good atheist voices like yours to tell the truth and exposing the fundamentalists to be the dangerous frauds that they are. My wife, Joanna, has been a big fan of yours for years and fights for injured workers against corporate giants. She's an angel for workers and listens to you every night. Thank you, Anonymous, and bless you, Joanna. Regarding taxes, Prairie 2 writes in, you're wrong, sort of. Taxes are only at record lows for the rich. The poor are paying record high taxes, at least a record since we beat back the British East India Company. We didn't have the income tax until 100 years ago, but all taxes even then were structured to take from the rich. Republicans want to reinstate the 18th century concept of taxing the peasants and not a dime from the rich. Yeah, that's true. Well, thanks for the correction, Bruce. Well, that's why he's the economic affairs correspondent. Now, I've just got to do this from the Atlantic Magazine wire. I had this last week, and I looked at this and just went, what? No. Now, this is a little rough, and I've saved it till going in the top of the hour, so you have a few minutes to go gargle with Listerine or splash cold water on your face or something, but here it is. I love the way the Atlantic Wire sets it up. The news that will make you want to shut the blinds, go back to bed until next week, .. There's disturbing news out of South Korea that since August, officials there have found over 17,000 pills filled with human flesh. In particular, the placentas and ground-up bodies of dead Chinese babies. Feel free to walk away from your computer and shake your head for the next few minutes. Go ahead. Perhaps, it goes on, is equally disturbing than the dead baby. Quote, bodies were chopped into small pieces and dried on stoves before being turned into powder, end quote. Now, if, well, you'll really want to walk away, as I tell you, that people were, as the Associated Press reports, consuming these pills as stamina and enhancement boosters and putting themselves at risk. A customs official said in a report by the Korea Times, which was picked up by the BBC, quote, it was confirmed those capsules contain materials harmful to the human body, such as superbacteria. We need to take tougher measures to protect public health. But, end quote, but back to the babies. This report might just be official confirmation that was revealed in a Korean documentary that revealed this process. It aired last August and is actually true. Supposedly, the television team that put together the documentary paid a lot of money to get some of the pills, and when they tested them, found the pills' contents were 99.7% human. They were also able to tell the baby's gender from the powder, as well as a couple other things here that I just can't say because it'll hit my gag reflex and that's it. What is it about the Chinese? What is it about the Chinese that... I mean, apparently there's no bottom for this particular culture. There's just no bottom at all. It just keeps going down, 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 just deeper and deeper and deeper into... I mean, you know, you leave human and get into, subhuman, and then you get into non-human, and then you get into... beast. I mean, what is it about the Chinese that they will grind up? I can't even do it. Oh my God. When do the anti-women's privacy people make a trip to China and start screaming at the, of course, the Chinese? I mean, if somebody showed up and China started screaming about this stuff, the Chinese would say, come here a second, and take them out behind a building and put a bullet in their heads. Now, you'll stop talking, yes? Oh. And then they would lose their internal organs, which would immediately go on the market. I mean, are the Chinese, are they stupid or insane, or both? Or are they very, very... are they transcendent human beings and understand that it's just human flesh? I mean, it's no different from pig flesh. It's no different from chicken flesh. So, I mean, pills. And you know who eats the pills, right? Probably very, very wealthy people who are led to believe that these pills will do something. I don't know. But the fact is that it's a good way to get Jakob Creutzfeldt disease, right? Doesn't that come from humans consuming brain matter of other humans? I'm sure Prairie 2 will write to me about that. Okay. All right. Huh? How do you feel? You want to come back for another hour? I won't do that to you again. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Welcome back. 7 past the hour. I'm still trying to get over that Newsweek cover. America's first gay president, huh? Oh, man, aren't the preachers going nuts? Imagine constitutional rights for people, the same equal protection under the law. Oh, that's enough to send Jesus twirling on his cross, isn't it? Huh? Except it's not. Jesus would have been the first one to say to these preachers, oh, shut up and sit down, for heaven's sake. But that's a different topic. I wanted to get to this. Editorial that was in the Times the other day, or was it today? I don't even know. But what it talks about is something another Republican freak ass from Florida, Daniel Webster, that's his name. He's probably I immediately think of this great American, Daniel Webster, great orator. I'll bet you this guy couldn't find his ass with both hands in a roadmap. But here he is, and I'll tell you why. Because this guy wants to add an amendment to the Census Bureau's 2013 appropriation that will forbid any money from being spent on what is called the American Community Survey. Now, what that survey does, it learns about various areas in the country, the economy, businesses, income, employment, homeownership, other important features. But this freak bastard, do these Republicans sit around every night and while they're picking boogers, try to come up with something that is as outrageous as you can imagine to then incorporate into American law? What is wrong with these people? What is wrong with these people? As the Times says, this is know-nothingness at a new level. Now, what is the American Community Survey? It gives annual updates of America's economic, demographic, and housing characteristics. It's considered a vital tool for business decision makers. It's also a bipartisan creation. It was first used in 2005. It is a more timely and accurate way to ask questions that used to be posed in the so-called long-form Census Bureau that came out every 10 years, or was it every 20? In 2006, Republican congressional staff members participated in efforts to promote the survey under the slogan, Better Data for Better Decisions. Republicans were promoting it. But that was then. That was then. Now, last week, 224 Republicans and 23 Democrats voted to cut the Bureau's 2013 budget, $88 million below last year's total, and $116 million below the White House request. So on top of ending the American Community Survey, this butchered budget would cripple the economic census. That's a survey of nearly 5 million businesses conducted every 5 years. And that survey is a foundation for economy-wide statistics on growth, inflation, productivity, and consumer spending. Ba-boom, boop-boom. Now, why would they want to do this? Why? Well, according to the Times, the survey cuts would reduce understanding about what is happening in the economy and the effectiveness of business and government policy. Lack of information can lead to paralysis and costly mistakes. And when Republicans proposed similar cuts last year, even the psychos in the U.S. Chamber of Commerce opposed them. So why? Why would they want to cut this out? Because Mr. Daniel Webster says asking these questions is an unconstitutional breach of privacy. What? A breach of privacy? You mean like telling a woman she can't consult with your own physician and have an abortion? That kind of privacy? Or what are you talking about, Webster, you son of a bitch? What are you talking about? A breach of privacy to gather data on businesses, schools, communities, the trends within a community, how many roads got potholes in them, how many electric grids are down. What is wrong with these Republicans? Every single one of them is insane. That's what's wrong with them. And 23 Democrats? Well, why does that surprise me? 224 Republicans and 23 Democrats went along with this psychopathological Daniel Webster. What a misnamed freak this guy is, right? Republican of Florida! Let's take the money away from them! We don't want information! We don't want to know about people! That's an unconstitutional breach of privacy! Now, how much do you want to bet? What do you want to bet? $1 trillion? A quadrillion? I mean, the whole planet? Let's bet the solar system. What do you want to bet that this rat bastard, Daniel Webster, would be the first to jump up on his hind legs and scream that a woman does not have a right to privacy where it concerns an abortion? What do you want to bet? Huh? I'll call your solar system and raise you the whole goddamn galaxy. How's that? What is wrong with these people? Aside from the fact that every one of them is sociopathological to the point of being, just pissing me off, I guess. I mean, it's astonishing. Quit asking questions. Why?
I don't know.
It's unconstitutional breach of privacy. I mean, how does this guy, not that I care, I would no more try to get inside his head than I would try to get inside a rotting, maggot-encrusted horse corpse. But I'm just curious, how does this guy in his fevered brain square the idea that asking questions, demographic questions is a breach of privacy? But interfering in a woman's decision to control her own body is not? Can somebody explain this to me? You right-wing dorks! You people are crazy. The survey cuts would reduce understanding about what is happening in the economy and the effectiveness of business and government policy. You talk about the blind leading the half-wits. What is it? You know, I say this over and over and over again. What is it about these Republicans? What drove them crazy? Did their mamas used to strip them naked and beat them with barrel slats? Did their daddies used to take them into the shower and show them his so that they wouldn't be gay? What is with these people? We don't want no stinking information. We want to fly blind. It's an invasion of privacy. Of course, prodding something up a woman's vagina, that's not an invasion of privacy. That's a right of ownership. I can't stand it. I really can't. There's something else I want to share with you that was in the paper on Sunday. You know, I call capitalists every single name I can think of except human. And, you know, every once in a while I get letters from people saying, come on, like, they can't be that bad. You know, I'm so glad that an essayist and critic and author and so on and so forth agrees with moi, or I agree with him, I don't know. But there was a piece in the Sunday's paper called Capitalists and Other Psychopaths. And I just got to share this with you when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Me. I got a double O18, a Martin guitar in.
1,000 watts of free speech. It's Mike Malloy.
I'm gonna leave the city. Got to get away.
21 past the hour. Daniel Webster.
Let's not ask any questions about anything. Let's just be dumb and stupid.
Good God. Oh, well. There is an ongoing debate in this country, William Derasiewicz writes, or William Derasiewicz, There's an ongoing debate in this country about the rich, who they are, what their social role may be, whether they are good or bad. Well, consider the following. A recent study found that 10% of people who work on Wall Street are, quote, clinical psychopaths, end quote, exhibiting a lack of interest in and empathy for others and, quote, an unparalleled capacity for lying, fabrication, and manipulation, end quote. Now, apparently the proportion at large is just 1%, but on Wall Street it's 10%. Another study, and I think we mentioned this on the program, concluded that the rich are more likely to lie, cheat, and break the law. Oh, really? Well, look at Limbaugh. And as Derasiewicz writes, the only thing that puzzles me about these claims is that anyone would find them surprising. Wall Street is capitalism in its purest form, and capitalism is predicated on bad behavior. This should hardly be news. 3 centuries ago, the English writer Bernard Mandeville asserted as much in a satirical poem cum philosophical treatise called The Fable of the Bees. The book's subtitle was Private Vices, Public Benefits, 300 years ago. Mr. Mandeville argued that commercial society creates prosperity by harnessing our natural impulses, which are fraud, luxury, and pride. Now, by pride, Mandeville meant vanity. By luxury, he meant the desire for sensuous indulgence. These create demand, as every advertising exec knows. On the supply side, as we'd say, was fraud. Quote, all trades and places knew some cheat. No calling was without deceit, end quote. That's from the poet. In other words, Enron, BP, Goldman Sachs, Philip Morris, GE, Merck, etc., etc., etc. Accounting fraud, tax evasion, toxic dumping, product safety violations, rig-bigging, overbilling, perjury. The Walmart bribery scandal, the News Corp hacking scandal, just open up the business section of an average newspaper on an average day. Shafting the workers, hurting the customers, destroying the land, leaving the public to pick up the tab. These aren't anomalies. This is how capitalism works. You get away with what you can, and you try to weasel out of everything when you get caught. Ah, right? Think about it. Accounting fraud, tax evasion, toxic dumping, product safety violations, bid rigging, overbilling, perjury, scandals, hacking, bribery. Shaft your workers, hurt your customers, destroy the land. Let the public pick up the tab. This is how capitalism works. So all you idiots who try to call this program in your inarticulate, brain-dead, right-wing way, try to tell me that, oh, well, you're a capitalist. Are you really? What makes you a capitalist? Huh? Because you have a painting company? Does that make you a capitalist? Oh, good for you. Derasiewicz goes on, I always found the notion of a business school amusing. What kinds of courses do they offer? Robbing widows and orphans? Grinding the faces of the poor? Having it both ways? Feeding at the public trough? Is that what you learn in business school? There was a documentary several years ago called The Corporation that accepted the premise that corporations are persons and then asked what kind of people they are. The answer was precisely psychopaths. In other words, indifferent to others, incapable of guilt, exclusively devoted to their own interests. There are ethical corporations, yes, and ethical business people, but ethics in capitalism is purely optional, purely extrinsic. To expect morality in the market is to commit a category error. Capitalist values, by the way, are antithetical to Christian ones. And it's amusing how the loudest so-called Christians in our public life can also be the most bellicose proponents of an unbridled free market. How they do that is a matter for their own consciences, right? Capitalist values are also antithetical to democratic ones. Like Christian ethics, the principles of Republican government requires us to consider the interests of others, Republican small r. Capitalism would have us believe that it's every man for himself. We'll be right back with more of this. This is fascinating the hell out of me. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Before the hour. So why is it so difficult to see capitalism as being anti-life, anti-happiness, anti-human, anti-children, anti-everything? What is it? There are all sorts of economic systems that works so much better than capitalism for everybody. But what happened? What was it? I guess it was the 60-year-long Cold War where three generations of Americans had their brains removed, scrubbed clean, and put back in. And the resulting belief was that the only economic system that made any sense was the one that Jesus liked, capitalism. The one that God ordained for America, capitalism. That's how thorough the brainwashing was. As Mitt Romney's dad said when he came back from Vietnam in 1968, after having traveled over there during the 68 presidential campaign, the run-up to Republican nomination, I should say. But former Michigan Governor Romney came back and said, I've been brainwashed. And of course, that was the end of his political career, because even though he's a Republican, or probably because he was a Republican, to admit that he'd been lied to by American media, American political leaders, and the American military, he had been lied to as a governor of a state, that there was light at the end of the tunnel. And of course it was. It was the headlight of an onrushing freight train. And America eventually lost, but at the expense of how much in terms of human life? Capitalism is a lie. What does it take? How do we get so brainwashed like Mitt Romney's dad? How did everybody get so brainwashed? William Derasevich, if I'm pronouncing it right, writing in the Sunday Review section of the Times, goes on with his piece about capitalists and other psychopaths. He said, there's been a lot of talk lately about job creators, a phrase begotten by Frank Luntz, the right-wing propaganda guru on the ghost of Ayn Rand. The rich deserve our gratitude as well as everything they have, in other words, and all the rest is envy. They deserve our gratitude and their $80 million yachts and their huge aircraft. But they deserve it. Why? Because they're job creators. Are they really? Are they really? How many jobs did... Oh, never mind. First of all, if entrepreneurs are job creators, workers are the wealth creators. You get that? Entrepreneurs take wealth to create jobs for workers. Workers use labor to create wealth for entrepreneurs. The excess productivity over and above wages and other compensation that goes to corporate profits. It's neither party's goal to benefit the other, but that's what happens nonetheless. Also, entrepreneurs and the rich are different and only partly overlapping categories. Most of the rich are not entrepreneurs. They are executives of established corporations, institutional managers of other kinds, the wealthiest doctors and lawyers, the most successful entertainers and athletes, people who simply inherited their money, or people who work on Wall Street. Now, most important, as William Derasevich points out, most important, neither entrepreneurs nor the rich have a monopoly on brain, sweat, or risk. There are scientists and artists and scholars who are just as smart as any entrepreneur, only they're interested in different rewards. A single mother holding down a job and putting herself through community college works just as hard as any hedge fund manager. A person who takes out a mortgage or a student loan or who conceives a child on the strength of a job she knows she could lose at any moment assumes as much risk as someone who starts a business. Enormous matters of policy depend on these perceptions. What we're going to tax and how much. What we're going to spend and on whom. But while the term job creators may be a new term, the adulation it expresses and the contempt that it so clearly signals are not. Kurt Vonnegut wrote in Slaughterhouse-Five, quote, poor Americans are urged to hate themselves, and so they mock themselves and glorify their betters, end quote. He added that our most destructive lie, quote, is that it is very easy for any American to make money, end quote. That lie goes on. The poor are lazy and stupid and evil, and the rich are brilliant, courageous, and good. They shower their beneficence upon the rest of us. Yeah, sure they do. Mandeville, the guy writing three centuries ago, who wrote the combination poet philosophical treatise called Private Vices, Public Benefits, The Fable of the Bees, he believed that the individual pursuit of self-interest could redound to public benefit. But unlike Adam Smith, he didn't think it did so on its own. Adam Smith's so-called hand was, quote, invisible. The automatic operation of the market. Mandeville's involved, quote, the dexterous management of a skillful politician, end quote, or in modern terms, legislation, regulation, and taxation. But you listen to any so-called capitalist today, what do they want to get rid of? Legislation, regulation, and taxation. Capitalists and other psychopaths. If you get a chance, go online, New York Times, and read it from Sunday's review section. I don't have any problem ever with considering the back and forth definition of capitalist, psychopath, psychopath, capitalist, back and forth. My grandfather, the Italian immigrant, owned a business, built up an enormous individual worth in stocks and bonds before, from his business, from his sweat, before the crash in 29. That wiped him out. He built up another enormous, for the times, fortune, my grandfather. And when he died, he left a huge stack of money. All of it had its genesis in the 18-hour days he worked in his combination gas station and tire store. Some of my earliest memories are smelling gasoline and watching him vulcanize, there's a term you don't hear anymore, vulcanize the inner tube, there's a term you don't hear anymore, of somebody's automobile tire. I can remember standing there when I'm 5 or 6 years old watching him do that. This guy who barely spoke English. And yet he would tell you he was a capitalist. It was astonishing. I mean, at the time, I had no idea, but he used to tell me, I'm a capitalist. I own Coca-Cola. Because he had shares. I own General Motors. Because he had shares. Now, this is a guy with, according to the family story, my mother and my uncles and aunts, this is a guy who had no more than the equivalent of a fourth grade education, who left Italy when he was 14. His parents sent him away because they were all starving to death in Italy. And he came here, and eventually he was a junk dealer for a while, a push cart, picking up metal and trash off the streets of Chicago. And then he moved to north central Ohio and opened up this business. The reason I bring this up is because this is a guy who busted his ass 6 days a week. The seventh day went to church. He was a laborer. He was not a capitalist. He was a laborer. And he earned money by just working himself crazy. But he used to tell me, I'm a capitalist. Because he, too, apparently had been brainwashed. Now, was my grandfather a psychopath? No, which proves my point that he wasn't a capitalist. He was a nice guy. He really was. A little reticent, a little quiet, you know, immigrant. Got sucked into that crazy Protestantism so that he could lose his identity. You know, Sacco and Vanzetti and all that. Ooh, didn't want to be Italian back then. And of course, the anarchists that were destroying Italy, which gave rise to Mussolini, right? Oh, it's a very interesting story. Only to me. Only to me. But anyway, capitalists and psychopaths, they're interchangeable terms. They really are.
I gave him a hug and he gave me his autograph. Hearing aids, new shoulders and new legs. My dad needs a break, he works all day every day. My brother needs a place and a job where he can make enough money to take care of his baby.
Affiliation of millionaires and billionaires and babies. These are the days of miracle and wonder. This is the law
that troubles away.
Wish I was a Hitler on a long mountain trip. Wish I was a Hitler on a long mountain
trip. 10 before the hour. So, America's first gay president. Wasn't that cute? That's a Tina Brown cover, I'm sure, on the Newsweek. There's Barack Obama with a halo over his head, and the halo is rainbow-colored. America's first gay president. What they called Clinton was America's first black president, right? I don't know why. I don't know why they ever called him that. I think Clinton did... damn near as much as George Wallace to destroy the fabric of black society in this country, such as it was. But what do I know? I'm a Caucasoid. I shouldn't comment on stuff like that. But after Obama made his decision, America's first gay president, and according to the Times, 2 hours after deciding to support same-sex marriage, he got on the phone and had a conference call with eight, give or take a few, African-American preachers trying to explain himself. And according to reports, the ministers were not all terribly enthusiastic. And a few made it clear that Mr. Obama's stand on gay marriage might make it difficult for them to support his reelection. I don't get this. After he talked to the African-American preachers, he talked to European-American president or preacher. Who was the guy? Joel Hunter. That's right. Joel Hunter. Pastor of a conservative megachurch in Florida. Now, in the first place, if it's a megachurch, it has nothing to do with Jesus. It is a demon worshiping center, by definition, by Jesus' own definition. We all know that. But anyway, so he calls this guy up, Joel Hunter, and Hunter says he told the president, quote, some of the faith communities are going to be afraid that this is an attack against religious liberty. How could that be? How could this is a part that drives me insane. And this is the reason I keep bringing up this religious garbage. I know you're tired of it. Well, what can I say? How is accepting the rights of people to form a marriage contract not once blessed by some church or mosque or temple or synagogue? Not at all. Has nothing to do with that. Has to do with a contract issued by the state within which the two people live. Oh, did I mention they're gay? Well, let's not leave that out, right? So how is affirming? Obama didn't pass any legislation. He can't. He didn't sign any executive orders. He can't. How is affirming the right of people to form a contract? How is that a threat to religious liberty? These people just disgust me. They disgust me. Do you hear? They just disgust me. So Obama, poor President Obama, it's almost like, I don't know, I just get this image of a kid stealing cookies. And then when mama and auntie comes home and maybe one of the uncles stops by and the kid steps out and says, I had a cookie. I had a cookie. Oh, I'm sorry. That's what this sounds like. Obama told some of these preachers, quote, we're both practicing Christians. And he's referring to himself and his wife in an ABC News interview in which he discussed these views. He says, we're both practicing Christians, and obviously this position may be considered to put us at odds with the views of others. How so? Where in Christian theology does it even mention same sex anything? Where? What the hell are they talking about? Somebody, please show it to me. Oh, don't go back to this tribal nonsense of the Jews that used to wander, or I'm sorry, the Hebrews. These tribes that used to wander the desert 6,000 years ago and had admonitions against something. I don't know, something about laying with a man as you would with a woman. Whatever that meant to them and whatever the context was, but that belongs to the Hebrews. Where did Jesus ever say anything? So the whole thing is just disgusting. It's like this freak from Florida who says he doesn't want the Census Bureau to, he wants to defund the part of the Census Bureau that collects demographic information because that's a violation, a constitutional violation of right to privacy. This little half-ass that said that, Daniel Webster, representative from Florida, Republican, would he say the same thing about a woman's? Oh, never mind, Christ. You can go crazy. It's like chasing your tail. Round and round and round in a circle. So poor Barack Obama. This is his character flaw, I guess. He makes a decision based on law, based on the Constitution, equal protection under the law. And he finally brings himself to say, okay, look, you know, say it publicly. I'm sure Obama probably never had a problem with same-sex marriage. Why should he? It has nothing to do with religion. Damn it. Nothing to do with religion. It's the religious Nazis who are turning it into something to do with religion. What did Jesus say about abortion? Nothing. Now, he talked a lot about, or a couple examples of raising the dead. Why don't you Christians ever talk about that? Shouldn't there be some laws about raising the dead? But gay marriage or marriage between same-sex couples? What? Oh, I know. It's just a pain in the tuchus to keep talking about this, right? I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.